Hey everybody, welcome to Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore, because the paint is the project. You know, if you're going to put in the work, make sure it's going to last. Use the good stuff. All right, here's what we've got coming up on the show today. At the end, I'm going to be digging into the world of William Morris, the man behind those famous wallpapers who ended up reshaping design as we know it. Before that, I'm going to walk you through how to prep and paint a metal outbuilding when you don't even have running water on the job site. But right now, I want to talk about something that's kind of one of those frustrations for a lot of homeowners. You know, not all of us, but there's a good chance that you're either dealing with this right now or you will run into it at some point in your career as a homeowner. Here's the scenario. A tree comes down on your property, right? Or you take it down, whatever. But you don't have somebody come out to grind out the stump. Now, maybe you couldn't afford it. Maybe you didn't think of it. Maybe, you know, you just didn't want to drop the money on it. You could have afforded it, but you'd rather buy something really fun than to spend that money getting a stump taken away from your yard. I mean, it's not a fun way to spend money. Either way, you left it. And as time goes by, it just sits there, right? And it becomes a forever part of your landscaping. You mow around it. Sometimes you use it as a base when you're playing baseball. You trip over it from time to time and so on. It's not a good look. And in most cases, stumps negatively affect the beauty of our outdoor spaces. But getting rid of them isn't always so simple. I mean, you could carve a bear into it. I should have added that to my list of things you could do with it, because I've seen that. People will carve some kind of animal into it, but that's probably not for everybody. Anyway, getting rid of them isn't always so simple, all right? But it is doable. So let's cover and dig into some affordable, I love affordable, one of my favorite words. We'll talk about some affordable DIY-friendly ways to remove tree stumps and roots without calling in a contractor and without renting anything that requires a trailer and a waiver and all of that stuff. All right, now first off, do you need to get rid of a stump and the roots, you know, once you cut it down? And this is the place to start, really, with this conversation, because if you don't hate how it looks or it's not in a place that's really detracting from the look of your yard, is it really necessary to remove it? Am I just giving you busy work? Or is this something that you need to take care of? Well, if you don't hate how it looks or it's not in a place that's really detracting from the look of your yard, it's probably technically not necessary to remove it. You know, it's not going to hurt anything immediately. Now, I notice I did say the word immediately. That's the word I chose there. It's not going to hurt anything immediately. There is a little foreshadowing in that, so we'll get to that in a minute. But you can leave them in place and eventually they'll just rot away on their own. Right? It'll go the natural way of everything. You know, we're all doing it right now. Everything will rot away on its own. So that's good. The problem is that eventually it could be years, right? You know, eventually rotting away. It could take them years to do that. And in the meantime, they're in the way. The stumps are. They get covered by grass. All the things that we talked about. They become trip hazards. You got to mow around them, blah, blah, blah. So you got to deal with that all that time. You know, is that really all that fun? Is that something you want to deal with? That's for you to decide. But there is something that I haven't mentioned, and it's something that I had not thought about with stumps that you leave in the yard. And it's a little thought that's going to get in your head and kind of make you want to act on this. They can become homes for carpenter ants, termites, and all their fun little insect friends. And that could be a problem that you regret down the road. So you might want to get them out. You can leave them, but you might want to get them out. All right. So if you do want to get it out, how do you reasonably and affordably, one of my favorite words in the English language, affordably, you know, it's just so sweet whenever that's used, you know, in any situation. How do you affordably and easily get these things out? I want to talk about what I think is probably the best overall route for homeowners. And then I've got a couple other ways that will help you. And then, you know, some last ditch efforts. But this first one, the work is going to start by just taking a good look at the problem, right? You just got to go out there and assess the situation. So head out after the show, look things over a little bit, you know, measure the diameter of the stump. If you can, try to get a sense for how deep that root system might go. You know, that's pretty tricky to do, but you could get some idea by looking at it. If the stump is small, you know, maybe 8 inches across or less, and if the roots don't seem to be too widespread, it's a great candidate for a hands-on, no-rental approach. And what most people will do in this situation is to just start by digging. You know, you just want to start exposing the base of the stump. You're looking to gain access to the big support roots. But before you start all that digging, you've got to call Miss Dig, you know, 811. They're going to come out. It'll take several days. There's a process. You want to get on it. But they'll come out and mark everything. You don't want to hit a gas line. You don't want to hit a utility line or anything while you're going after the roots. That's a sad situation, and it can happen kind of quickly. So call 811, call Miss Dig 811 before you start your digging. All right, now once you've done that and everything's marked, a good shovel is really all you need to get started. But you're probably going to want a mattock or a pickaxe. These are both fun things to say and fun things to own, and they're not going to be expensive. So get one of those or both, and that's going to help you cut through the compacted soil. Now, it's a workout, right? There's no way around this, but you're using a pickaxe or maybe a mattock or both, and that's going to make you look and feel pretty cool. You know, you'll be sore, but you're going to look super cool. All right, so it's an even trade. On top of that, this works. You know, it takes time, but it works. All right, so dig at it. Once the roots start revealing themselves, that's the wrong way to say it. They're not revealing themselves. It makes it sound like they're doing the work. You're doing the work. Once you start revealing the roots, the goal is to cut them, right? I mean, not rocket science here. An axe will work, but a bow saw or a reciprocating saw, something like a sawzall, something like that, is going to be way faster. Now, of course, if you're going to go the power tool route, you know, probably or anything, you know, you take care of you, but throw on some safety glasses, gloves, things like that. And also be careful with the power tool with your blade. You know, cutting through roots is hard on tools, you know, because you've got the dirt there. It's just hard to get a nice clean approach to it on all of the different roots that you're going to be cutting off. So keep a few extra blades on hand. Now, one of my favorite little tricks is to water that area the day before you start. You know, not right before. You don't want mud, you know, or anything like that. But damp ground is going to be softer than hard-packed earth, of course, and it's going to be easier on your blades when they hit it. Now, once you've cut through the major roots, the stump is basically freed. What you want to do here is to use your shovel or your mattock as a lever and kind of just start rocking the stump back and forth. And that's going to break the last stubborn feeder roots that are still holding on. Now, for smaller stumps, you know, maybe under 6 inches or so in diameter, you can usually pry and wiggle them out by hand, you know, like a tooth once they're loose enough. It's satisfying work when it gives way. You know, you're going to feel like some kind of He-Man or He-Woman or whatever you want to feel like. It's pretty cool. For bigger stumps, this is where people often reach for a truck and a chain. But honestly, that's where things get a little dicey, a little dangerous. We've all seen social media videos of really, really bad scenarios when people do this. Chains can snap, trucks can lurch. I've seen the stump shoot out and hit the back of the truck and take out the back window. All kinds of terrible things. People get hurt. If you're going to go that route, at least use a proper toe strap instead of a chain. Go slow and go steady, no jerking, and really keep everybody back from the action, right? Everybody. And this is all on you. This is not from my recommendation that you're choosing to do this. But if you do, take whatever steps you need to be safe. And honestly, really, for something bigger than a dinner plate, you're probably better off moving on to other methods entirely. And you've got a couple main options here. They're still DIY friendly. The patient approach, you could do that. You could take chemicals and use the patient approach, or you could rent some serious machinery. Let's talk about the chemical method first, because sometimes the best tool is just time. You know, you don't want to give it all the time to rot itself out of the ground. That's too much time. But the chemical route, that might be a better way to go if it's bigger than a dinner plate. Now, I wasn't aware of this, and I probably should have been, but you can buy stump remover at most hardware stores. You know, it's usually potassium nitrates. You could find that. Or really, you can just use Epsom salts. You basically just drill some holes into the top of the stump, right? An inch wide or so, a few inches deep, a bunch of holes spaced across the surface. Then you pour in the salt, pour in the stump remover. If it's granules, then you'd add water. Some stump removers are going to come liquid. Most of them will be granules. But pour in the salt, pour in the stump remover, add water, and then cover the stump with a tarp. Now, the tarp's going to help retain moisture, it's going to help retain heat, and both of those are going to, of course, speed up the breakdown. And after a few weeks, sometimes a little bit longer, it softens enough that you can start chopping it apart with a shovel or an axe. Now, it's not quick, you know, it's not, you know, instantaneously removed from the yard, but it's low effort, and it's super budget-friendly, and it's really not going to take that long. So if you get on it now, maybe in a month or so, you've got it out of the ground. All right. Now, some people like to burn stumps. That's another way that the internet will recommend. It's one of the, you know, recommended methods out there. But personally, I'd skip that one. Skip it. Between the smoke, the legality questions, can you even do this in your area? The smell of it, you know, burnt stump, not really as fun as it sounds. Plus, it rarely gets everything. Yeah, you end up left with this charred mess and possibly, you know, possibly angry, frustrated neighbors. Who knows? I wouldn't burn it out. Don't do that. Use the stump remover if it's a big stump, or, you know, maybe it's better to just go and rent a grinder and get it out that way. Now, renting a grinder probably going to cost around a couple hundred bucks or so for the day, depending on where you get it from. But in the right hands, that'll reduce a great big massive stump to mulch in less than an hour. You still need to do some prep. You've got to clear the rocks, branches, stuff like that. Maybe cut the stump down lower with a chainsaw. But really, it's a good compromise between full DIY of digging it out and hiring a professional. You know, if you've got a big stump to deal with, this might be a way to go. Just be aware, of course, I don't even need to say this, but it's on the radio and everybody's listening. So I guess I do have to say it. Stump grinders aren't toys, of course. So wear safety glasses, hearing protection, gloves, follow the instructions. And if it looks too intimidating, just call somebody who's done it before and go that route. All right. However you've removed the stump, the last thing that you need to do is to smooth everything out, of course, and get your yard back in order. So fill the hole with a mix of topsoil, maybe some of the wood chips or the dirt that you dug out. Pack it down lightly. You want to leave it slightly mounded to allow for settling, and then throw some grass seed on it. You know, water it really well. And in a few weeks, you'll never know the tree was even there. And fall is a really great time to do this and get that grass growing. So there you go. Removing a stump. Number of different ways to go. Some of them more affordable than others, but all of them should get you to the point where you've got a nice, pristine yard. Once again, no more tripping, no more mowing around that thing. All right. That's removing tree stumps. Now, I've got a little bit of time before next segment, so I want to take a moment to address an email that I received this week about the show from the week before. Now, if you remember, last week we had a car guy expert on, Chris Hardesty. He writes for Auto Trader and Kelley Blue Book, and we talked about the best colors for cars in terms of resale value, safety, and so on. Anyway, I received an email from Kurt who wanted me to know that he really liked the segment, but he thought we missed something big when it came to the conversation on car colors in terms of maintenance. Kurt wrote, "Gloss black is by far the easiest color to match for touch-up and repair, which is why for 40 years plus, all of my Jeeps have been black. Super easy to remediate chips and blemishes." End quote. So there you go. I told Kurt that I'd work that correction into the show, and I managed to do it. Promises made, promises kept. That's my way. All right. How do you measure, prep, and paint a metal building? It's a great question that I received from a customer, and it comes with a little bit of a twist. We'll get to that right after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Top-tier paint, expert advice. Your next project is way easier than you think it's going to be. All right, let's dive into a paint question that I received this past week. And before I do, I want to remind you that you can send your paint and design questions to radio@repcolight.com. I'll answer them via the email, you know, right away, you'll get your answer. But if I end up using your question on the show, like I'm doing with this one right now, I'll send you a gift certificate for a free gallon of Benjamin Moore or Repco Light paint. You choose. And if that sounds like a good deal, make sure you send your paint and design questions to radio@repcolight.com. All right, let's get to the question for the week. And it really seemed straightforward and simple right off the bat until it wasn't. I'll get to that in a minute. It started like this. A gentleman emailed me and asked how to figure out how much paint he needed to paint an old metal building. All right, super straightforward. And it's good info to have and to know because this is going to help you assess how much paint you need for any paint project. So to figure out how much paint you'll need, you first need to figure the square footage of your space. You know, not the floor square footage, but the wall square footage. And you do that by taking the length and multiplying it by the height. You do that for each wall or each surface area, add them all together, then subtract the square footage of windows and doors, and once you've got that number, That's the square footage that you need to cover. Now, to figure out how much paint you need, you generally just assume that a gallon's going to give you about one coat on 400 square feet if it's a sealed surface. So that should help you get a ballpark for how much paint the project's going to require. So that's the first step, measuring for the paint. And if you missed any of that math, I know I went fast, check out our blog post on paint measuring. You know, it's not the most exciting post of all time, but it will help you figure out how to do that measuring for pretty much any project you're working on. So you can find that online at repcolite.com. Just click the blog tab on the main header and you're good to go. All right, once you've got that figured out, for this instance, now you just need to do the work to get that building painted. So I just rolled on with my answer and explained that, like most paint projects, all of this is going to start with the prep work. You know, in this instance, we're talking about a metal building, and these buildings get dirty, they get chalky, they get rusty over time. So you need to really give it a good cleaning. You know, scrub it with TSP or a TSP substitute, and then rinse it thoroughly and let it dry. On a metal building, rust is going to be a big enemy. You don't want to just paint over it. You've got to scrape it. You've got to hit it with a wire brush. You've got to get away all the loose stuff. You know, remove that, sand it smooth, and then hit that area with a rust inhibiting primer. If you skip that step, the rust is just going to keep growing under the paint and it's going to push it off, and you're going to have problems down the road way quicker than you would like. So once you've got it all prepped, it's time to paint. And for the main body of the building, you want a high-quality 100% acrylic water-based paint. Benjamin Moore's Element Guard or Regal Exterior, those are great options. So is Repcolite's Endura. These products are flexible enough to expand and contract with the building, and they're going to hold the color really well through the seasons. So that was my original answer. You know, that's it in a nutshell. I sent it off, and I felt really good about it until he replied with that major complication that I hinted at a little bit earlier. And here's the deal. He has no water available at the site. So his follow-up question was this: can I just dry brush the building for the cleaning and call it good? Well, here's the thing. As much as I hate to say it, dry brushing alone just isn't going to cut it. You know, paint in this instance is really going to just be bonding. You know, it's a surface bond. There's no penetration into metal. It's not like wood that it can soak into and get a little bit of a grip. It's metal. There's no penetration. It's just a surface bond. And if chalk and dirt are left behind on that surface, the paint will stick to that layer, that chalk and dirt layer, instead of the actual building. And then when that chalk lets go or the dirt lets go, the paint goes with it. And you'll see peeling way earlier than you should. So what does he do? You know, what's the solution if he doesn't have running water out there? Well, he's got to find a way to bring water to the building. And some folks do this by hauling 5-gallon pails of water or larger totes, you know, something like that. And then when they've got the water there like that, they scrub the siding using that water, you know, mixed with TSP or a TSP substitute, scrub it on and get it cleaned. And then to rinse it, this is where it gets even trickier. You know, how do you do that? A lot of times people will pick up, you know, maybe a larger plastic garbage can, clean one, and fill that with the water that they brought in their 5-gallon buckets. Then you can drop a submersible pump into that and run a garden hose off of it. Just remember, these pumps, these submersible pumps, they're designed to move water steadily. So forget about using a spray nozzle at the end of the hose. Instead, just leave the hose open and use your finger, you know, old school style, to get a jet going. To get the building rinsed. It's not glamorous. It's not terribly wonderfully easy to pull off, but it will work. All right, coming up, William Morris is one of the key voices of the arts and crafts movement, and his ideas on beauty and craftsmanship still shape our homes today. We're going to get to that right after this. This is Home in Progress, where the to-do list is long, and that's all right. We're not crabbing at you. We're not going to yell at you. That's how it is. It's how ours is, too. It's proudly supported by Repcolite Paints and Benjamin Moore, because home projects are easier when you've got people you can trust. All right, it's time to talk about William Morris. You know, the wallpaper guru, one of the founders of the arts and crafts movement, William Morris. I want to talk about him and five ways that he changed how we think about beauty in our homes, you know, beauty and design. And before I can jump into all of that, I do have to give you like an origin story, you know, some backstory info, because this is going to set up everything that follows. I'll try to move through it quickly so we can get to the really, really good stuff. But, you know, this stuff, you do need some of this to really establish the rest of the story. All right. To begin, we got to go back to the very beginning. Morris was born in 1834, just outside of London. All right, so 1834, William Morris enters the world, and as he grows up through those early years of childhood and such, he spends all of his days, you know, outside exploring. You know, and not all of his days, you know what I'm saying? He's outside a lot. You know, you can picture him, little kid running around in his knickerbockers, his suspenders. You know, he's wandering through woodsy areas, fields, gardens. He's touching everything. He's finding flowers, birds. He's probably running through poison ivy. Probably did that once. He was a good observer. He only had to do that once before he learned never, ever do that again. He's probably peeking in badger dens. He was curious. You know, the big bottom line is that he soaked everything in. You know, he's out in nature soaking it all in. You know, the color of the leaves as the different seasons play out, the way the vines wind around each other, the way birds are moving through the branches, all of that. He absorbs all of that. Now, when he gets older and it's time for college, he heads off to Oxford with the plan of studying theology. And that's where everything begins to change from, you know, where he thought he was going to go with his life into a, you know, a completely different direction. At Oxford, he meets Edward Burne Jones. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the name or not. Edward Burne Jones, he was a fellow student who would later go on to become one of Victorian England's most celebrated painters. Now, through Edward Burne Jones, William Morris is introduced to the Pre-Raphaelites. A group of artists. Just think of them as the long-haired proto-hippies of the Victorian art world. You know, that should at least give you a good vision of who they are. Their vision as artists was to move dramatically away from the idealized forms and the softened landscapes of the Royal Academy. And what they wanted to replace them with was, you know, vivid colors, incredibly intricate details, things like that. They wanted to represent what was truly there in the world and what the eye was truly seeing. You know, that's the important thing to take away. Truth in art, that's what they were after. And for Morris, that concept, that idea wasn't just interesting, it was completely electric. It completely captured him. You know, he'd already felt a little bit of those stirrings as a boy, wandering the countryside and soaking in nature, but with the Pre-Raphaelites, it all clicked into place. You know, what had been a feeling before was now a philosophy. Truth in art, truth in architecture, truth. You know, that's what he was after. Now, a little bit later, that philosophy that he's forming runs headfirst into a practical problem. You know, Morris gets married after college or after the time at Oxford, and he begins furnishing his first home. And when he's doing that, everything that he finds to put in the house is hideous. You know, it's mass-produced, it's over-ornamented, it's too much. You know, it's practically exactly what you'd expect to find in the Victorian era. So he's encountering all of this ugly decor, you know, for lack of a better word, and what's he going to do? Well, rather than tolerate what he couldn't stand, he decided to go to work designing things for himself. With help from his wife and his circle of artist friends, he spent 2 years creating furniture, textiles, glass, murals, you know, things that matched his ideals. And in 1861, you know, a few years have passed, he's outfitted his home with things that he's designed with his group of friends. And by 1861, that little experiment grows into a company, Morris, Marshall, Faulkner & Company. And it's a company producing everything from stained glass and hand-painted tiles to simple oak furniture and wallpapers. You know, basically the company wasn't interested in cranking out machine-made clutter. That wasn't its purpose. Its goal was to help everyday people fill their homes with objects that were truly beautiful and functional. Basically, he wanted to do for others what he did for himself in his first home. So that was 1861 when that company was founded. Years later, in 1875, Morris took full control of the company and rebranded it Morris & Co. And that's how we know it today. So there you go. The backdrop, the childhood in nature, the friendships, the rebellion against the ordinary, all of that stuff. Now let's dig into 5 key ways that William Morris changed not just wallpaper, but the very way we think about beauty and design in our homes. All right, so the first one that we're going to cover is he rebelled against fakery, all right? Rebelled against fakery. In the Victorian era, fakery was everywhere. you know, absolutely everywhere. You walk into a fashionable home and you're going to see wallpapers pretending to be marble, wood, silk, you know, even velvet. Fireplaces, you know, fireplaces built from, you know, cheap slate. They're painted to look like they're fine stone. Pine furniture was brushed and wood grained, you know, so that it looked like mahogany. You know, even the baseboards were painted to mimic marble. Okay. And the artists who did this were really good. So it often took a really close look to figure out, you know, the trick and to figure out what the material actually was. And to William Morris, you know, he hated this. It was all deception. He saw it as all lying. You know, the wall's not velvet, but the wallpaper wants you to believe that it's velvet. That chair isn't oak, but you're supposed to think that it's oak. He hated all of that. And that instinct in him, that aversion to that fakery, was already in place years back when he refused to step foot in the Great Exhibition of 1851. Now, the Great Exhibition of 1851, it was a massive World's Fair inside the Crystal Palace, which was an enormous, enormous glass and iron wonder in Hyde Park. You know, this big World's Fair is going on, 1851. Millions of people are pouring in to marvel at the latest machine age miracles. You know, steam engines, printing presses, furniture stamped out by factories. At this point in time, Morris is 16 years old. His family buys tickets. You know, they're going in. They get their hands stamped so they can go back out and come back in again in case they need to use the bathroom or something. But Morris refuses to even go in the first place. And he refuses on principle. It's not just teenage angst or something like that. You know, he's not pouty because he's not hanging with his girlfriend. He's annoyed because everything inside this place, everything that they're lauding and promoting and displaying, all of it is gaudy and fake and soulless to him at 16. And he wants no part of it. So that was early on in his life. Later, his friendship with the Pre-Raphaelites that I mentioned earlier, that friendship deepens those ideas and those ideals. And he develops this passion that follows him the rest of his life, this passion to speak truthfully with his art, with his designs, and with the materials that he uses. You know, that just becomes ingrained in him. And that conviction shows up really interestingly in his first home, the Red House. Most Victorians would choose to cover brick. You know, when they built a house out of brick, they'd choose to cover it with stucco or paint or something like that, anything to cover that brick up. But Morris and his architect friend, Philip Webb, left theirs completely bare. Deep red brick, plain, unapologetic. You know, it was all about honest materials. It was about honest construction, hiding nothing. You know, just complete honesty. That same principle ends up running through all of his wallpapers and his textiles. You know, Morris drew his patterns from super careful observation, you know, sketching roses in his own garden, watching birds steal strawberries at his country home, things like that. But his wallpapers, they weren't trying to be nature or to fool you into thinking that your wall was a meadow. You know, that wasn't his goal. Instead, they celebrated what they actually were. You know, beautifully crafted patterns inspired by the natural world, but at the end of the day, still just images on paper. He wasn't trying to hide that fact. They were honest about being decoration, and they were honest about their inspiration and where it came from. And this was just a huge breath of fresh air in that time period. You know, by prioritizing honesty, William Morris challenged the Victorian assumption that beauty required pretense. His ideas sparked the arts and crafts movement, like we talked about at the very beginning. He influenced designers across Europe and America, all over the place, and he ended up paving the way for modernism's idea of form follows function. You know, even today, when we admire exposed brick, natural wood, or just simple organic patterns, we're still echoing Morris's vision. So that's the first way William Morris changed how we think about beauty and design in our homes. He replaced fakery with honesty. Now let's get to the second way that Morris changed how we think about design. And this builds directly on what we just talked about. For Morris, design wasn't just about taste, it was about morality. And this might sound a little extreme, but Morris believed something really, really radical, that living surrounded by lies, you know, even small ones like fake wood grain, living surrounded by lies actually changed who you were. You know, dishonest, cheap, or ugly design, he argued, didn't just offend the eye. You know, I'm not just offended, you know, visually or aesthetically by this. It actually damaged people. And on the flip side, good design, useful, beautiful, honest design, could make life better for everybody that it touched. He saw this at both ends of the spectrum, workers and consumers. So for workers, mass production completely drained, in his idea, in his mindset, completely drained the joy out of making anything. You know, by the 1880s, he was speaking out against the industrial system, and not just because it produced, you know, kind of ugly, shoddy products. He argued that factories instead, or as well, you know, also robbed craftsmen of their dignity. You know, instead of creating something beautiful from start to finish, workers, you know, were just reduced to repeating one tiny task all day long. So no creativity, no pride, no connection to the final product. You know, those were his ideas. It tore the workers down. It turned, you know, craftsmen into machines. And to Morris, this wasn't just unfair. It was dehumanizing, stripping away what made work meaningful. So huge, deep thoughts. And consumers, they weren't spared either. To Morris, you know, living surrounded by deceptive objects, you know, pine painted to look like oak, wallpaper pretending to be silk, things like that, you know, machine-made lace imitating handwork, surrounded by stuff like that, wasn't just settling for cheap substitutes. It was living, like, you know, living with lies. That was what he saw in this. We were living with lies. And day after day, he believed that those lies would dull our moral senses. You know, we get comfortable with falseness. We stop expecting truth. So for him, ugliness and dishonesty, they weren't just surface problems. They weren't just aesthetic issues. They were moral failures. And by contrast, a chair that's made with care or wallpaper printed by hand, it's not just prettier. It doesn't just look better. It's honest. It honored the maker. It honored the user. And when we talk today about authentic living, or when we choose quality over quantity, or when we feel drained by cheap disposable stuff, you know, that's Morris's insight still at work, you know, in how we feel about design and beauty in our homes. All right, the third way that Morris reshaped design is that he transformed wallpaper from something that you ignored into something that you studied. I love this point. Victorian wallpapers, they were incredibly elaborate. We talked about that. They were ornate. They were incredibly detailed. But here's the thing. They were designed to impress without really being examined all that much. You basically think of them, you know, Victorian wallpapers, think of them like background music, you know, at a fancy restaurant. You know, rich, costly, it fills every surface, but you're not really supposed to pay attention to it so much. Now, Morris completely changed that. He made wallpaper worth contemplating. And to do this, he had to break all the rules. You know, the design world at that point was split between, you know, basically two camps. Geometric reformers who wanted rigid stripes and mathematical shapes, you know, on the wall. And then there was the French ornate style in wallpaper that tried to look like, you know, carved plaster or silk brocade or whatever. It tried to make incredibly hyper-realistic, you know, visuals. Those were the two options. Morris really didn't like either one. So instead, he crafted something entirely new. Patterns drawn from nature, you know, naturalistic patterns, but not literal patterns. You know, the things he came up with were flat, but they were still alive. You know, the vines and flowers were arranged so your eye could follow the rhythm, you know, kind of trace the curves and feel the truth of how the plants grew. Critics, when they saw this new work, they were, you know, baffled, maybe is the right word. They were not immediately impressed. They called the papers peculiar because they didn't fit into any of the established or pre-existing categories. The architect, Richard Norman Shaw, for example, he dismissed them as just too bold. Quote, wallpaper, he said, should be a background pure and simple. But that was exactly Morris's point. He wanted wallpaper that engaged you, that invited you to look closer. You know, you could spend time with a Morris design, still can. You know, there's a lot to look at, you know, tracing the vines with your eyes, just a lot to look at. And it wasn't just the look, you know, it was the making as well. You know, at a time when most wallpapers were churned out by machine, Morris revived hand block printing. You know, some of the designs that he did required dozens, you know, of different blocks, weeks of labor, and layer upon layer of natural pigment. In an industrial age, you know, when everything is machine made, Morris chose craft over convenience, and he did it every single time. Artists and aristocrats immediately embraced his work, even though the critics maybe didn't. You know, these other folks saw what the critics were missing, that Morris had taken wallpaper and elevated it from, you know, just decoration on a wall or background noise to genuine art. And we still live with that shift today. You know, every time we choose a statement wallpaper for an accent wall or stop to really, you know, really look at a pattern on our walls, we're echoing Morris's revolution. He taught us that walls don't have to just sit quietly in the background. They can sit quietly in the background, and that's not bad either, but they can, you know, be focal points. They can be something that really draws the eye. They can be canvases worth contemplating. All right, the fourth way that Morris reshaped design is that he planted the seeds for making beauty accessible to everybody. Now, this one's complicated because Morris carried a contradiction at the heart of everything he did. You know, on the one hand, his dream was democratic, I guess is the way to say it. He believed every single person deserved beauty in their daily life, not just the wealthy people. And by choosing wallpapers and textiles as his medium rather than paintings or sculptures, he was deliberately working, you know, in materials and forms that could, in theory, you know, reach ordinary homes. But there's a problem. You know, Morris was uncompromising about quality. We talked about it a little bit. He insisted on hand printing. You know, he insisted on natural dyes and weeks of painstaking labor for every design. Now, I've got a video linked in the show notes that shows exactly what the process was like. And it's astonishing. You know, some Morris papers required 15 separate wood blocks, each one pressed carefully into place. And every time you watch the craftsman press it down, you can hear a cash register ding. Just listen for it. You can hear it. And that's the point I'm getting at. Because of the method, the papers that he made were crazy expensive. So expensive that only the wealthy and the upper middle class could even afford them. You know, exactly the opposite of what he was trying to do. And he knew this, and it really drove him nuts his entire career. He wanted to create beautiful things for everybody while also paying craftsmen a fair wage and using the finest materials and methods. But all of that together really ended up just being art for the elite. You know, that's what he ended up doing. So what's his real contribution here? You know, I guess I think it boils down to this. Morris established the principle that art belonged in everyday spaces. You know, he started the conversation that, you know, beauty is for everybody, regardless of your class or your income. According to him, the dining room in my house, my little nondescript house, that's just as worthy of displaying art and beauty as a museum gallery, right? And that's really, really radical. He was treating common homes with the same dignity as elite mansions or institutions. And while he couldn't practically make that all work out, you know, the way that he wanted to, he couldn't make that work out himself. Later designers were able to complete his vision. You know, they took the aesthetic principles that he established and eventually found a way to adopt them for mass production. And finally, when that happened, all of us, even the regular folks like us, I can only speak for myself, the regular folks like me could have access to truly beautiful items for our homes and our lives. You know, so Morris planted the seeds, others harvested the crops. And maybe, you know, just thinking about it, maybe his contradiction was necessary. You know, if he had compromised on quality, his designs might not have been compelling enough to inspire later generations. You know, by proving the value of beauty at the highest level, he kind of made the case for why everybody deserved access to it. At least that's a way to look at it. All right, finally, the fifth way that Morris changed how we feel about beauty and design. He didn't just influence products, he sparked a movement. You know, I've said it a few times already, but William Morris became the central figure in the arts and crafts movement. His ideas, you know, honest materials, using honest materials, and using them honestly, you know, that idea, the idea that beauty belongs in daily life, that dignity belongs in craft, all of those ideas formed the foundation for the arts and crafts movement. And for Morris, it wasn't just about style or just about aesthetics. You know, he was also pushing back against the dehumanization of both workers and consumers in the industrial age. You know, he was insisting on human dignity just as much as visual beauty. You know, and because of that, his influence spread way beyond wallpaper. You know, it reached into furniture, into architecture, into the homes that we live in, into even how we built and crafted those homes and that furniture. You know, Gustav Stickley's furniture, Frank Lloyd Wright's organic designs, the Craftsman bungalow, all of these things and way more carry Morris's DNA, and all of them trace back to his rebellion against mass-produced ugliness. And what's really interesting, last thing I'll get to, is that Morris didn't just, you know, stop with interior stuff. In 1891, just 5 years or so before he died, he launched the Kelmscott Press, one of the most famous private presses in history. You know, he designed typefaces, borders, illustrations, and he printed on handmade paper. His masterpiece, the Kelmscott Chaucer, which is definitely worth a look, is still considered one of the most beautiful books ever created. You know, but of course, you can see it coming from a mile away. That same contradiction that he struggled with his wallpaper and all of that followed him here. the books that he was making, they were so labor-intensive, they could only be afforded by wealthy collectors. Still, he did set a standard of beauty that others would later adapt and spread through modern printing technologies. So, the guy was just moving in all kinds of directions all the time. When he died in 1896, other people carried on the work at Morris & Co., but his influence really never stopped rippling outward. His designs, you know, wallpaper designs, they're still in print 150 years later. You know, his philosophy echoes every single time we choose fewer but better objects, every time we value the handmade over the mass-produced, and every time we insist that functional things can also be beautiful. Whenever we do that, we're channeling William Morris. So yeah, he gave us beautiful wallpaper, but he also left us with a reminder. You know, don't just fill your house with stuff. Choose things that matter. Surround yourself with objects that do their job well and bring you joy. Make it useful, make it beautiful, and your home's going to be better for it. All right, that's going to wrap it up for today's episode of Home in Progress, brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Thanks so much for hanging out with us a little bit today. We really appreciate it. And if you did enjoy the show, subscribe. You know, that would be great. You'll never miss another episode. And if you have a minute, leave a quick rating or review wherever you're listening, and that will really help us out, and it helps other people find the show. All right, for Home in Progress, I'm Dan Hansen. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I'll see you next time.